Are you ever scared to turn your phone off to recharge it, Elliot?
The last time I turned my phone off, actually, I should say this. The second last time I turned my phone off, the Toronto Maple Leafs traded for Dion Phaneuf and traded Jason Blake. So the only other time I've turned my phone off since then was when my son was born.
Right.
In 2011. Other than that,
it stays on.
It stays on.
And the ringer always stays on. The reason I ask
is the ringer doesn't always stay on.
Oh, so you're not the 2 a.m. Colorado and San Jose just made a Shattenkirk deal?
No,
you're not that guy?
I have Vibrate and it's right near me, so it usually works, but it's woken up my son before. So if I leave the ping on, I'll get hit with the 50% escrow, as we call it, divorce.
I'm just curious about the phone because as we were about to start recording this podcast, your phone went off. And I think to myself, does this guy ever turn that thing off?
Just twice in the last, when was Dion traded to Toronto? In 2008. So it's probably been 10 years twice.
Yeah, as I'm on my way back from doing ringside at a Montreal Canadiens game. I want to get to 31 Thoughts here.
The Carolina Hurricanes have a new owner, and he's promising to help the NHL franchise right here in the Triangle.
Yeah, his name is Tom Dundon. He was introduced by the team at the PNC Arena today.
Tom Dundon thinks he bought a good thing with the Hurricanes. I would hope so for $550 million, but his focus now is making a good thing great. And for him, that starts with the fan experience.
I don't think I'm happy with what a fan gets when they come here tonight. And other than the great hockey, we need to do more than that. And that's our focus right now is we want to make sure when someone comes here, they feel like they got value, they got entertainment, they want to tell their friends, and they want to come back.
It's always interesting to get to know new owners.
Yep.
And I think that one area, it's been exploited in other sports. You know this a lot better than I do. But in other sports, you know the owners. In football, the owners are stars. You know, in the NHL, players are stars, coaches are stars, GMs are stars, team presidents in some ways are stars. But we don't know a whole lot about the owners, but I think that's changing. And that's why I really enjoyed the opening of 31 Thoughts this week with a piece on Thomas Dundon, Carolina Hurricanes majority owner. I do get a little bit weird, though, when I start to see an owner come in and start throw around big terms and talk about big improvements, because the last guy that did that ended up getting Ville Leino and Christian Ehrhoff on huge contracts.
Yep.
And that was Terry Pegula with the Buffalo Sabres. What did you learn about Dundon in this piece?
I don't think he's going to follow the same path as Terry Pegula, probably because I think people will tell him. And when I asked him what was the best advice you'd gotten so far, his answer was along the lines of, don't think you can fix it without knowing what you're really doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see him as a guy who feels he can throw money at the problem. He also said, when he was talking about their budget on spending, because they're not ever a cap team, is that it comes down to value. We know our players best, and if it's 5% more money somewhere else and the guy, we want him, we're going to keep him. It's not going to be a question of money. He did bring up the irrationality of another team, though. And he says if somebody does something irrational and we don't see the value, that's not where we're going to keep a player. So I don't think he follows the Pegula path that way. Jeff, I will tell you it was interesting. I got some feedback after that.
Can you hold on to that feedback?
Sure.
I just want to ask you about one thing. The idea that if someone is offering more than we think that player is valued, we'll walk away. Because when I read that, you know what I saw?
What?
Offer sheet. That if someone comes,
how many of those happen?
I know, but I'm just saying, I think eventually it may just become more of a thing in the NHL, and I want to get to offer sheets a little bit later on. But is that not admission? Because we always hear the opposite. We always hear executives say, we will match any offer for player X, so don't even bother. When I read that, I said to myself, if someone comes in with a stupid offer sheet for a key player, is he saying we're going to walk away? We're not going to overpay for a big guy? He might be.
He might be. One thing I've learned is that value can be determined a lot of different ways. It's not just value on the ice. There's also something about value to your organization. Does the player sell tickets? Does the player sell merchandise? I think there's a lot of different things that go into value. I am with you in one thing. I do believe eventually we get to the day where offer sheets are a bit more common because there are just fewer great players hitting the market. You know, last year we had Stamkos and he stayed, but he got to the market, which was rare. This year, Tavares, we don't know where that's going to be. If he does hit the market, I mean, look out.
Chara hit the market. That was enormous.
But that was a while ago.
That was a long time. But it's still under the salary cap banner.
Yes. But we don't see those that much anymore. Game changers don't hit the market anymore. So I do think we are going to get the day where we see offer sheets more often. But the fact is that I think what he's trying to do is say that, you know, we're not going necessarily going to be a team that's 15 to 20 million under the cap like we are now. I get the sense he would like to convince people that those days are over.
Let's take this little side road here on offer sheets before I get back to the Carolina owner. Just about offer sheets, one of my main issues with them is when they're done. Doing them early in the summer to me makes no sense. If I'm a team and wants the player, and I want to put the other team in a pinch where they have to surrender the player, why not do it a week before the season? Like, why allow a team an entire summer to figure out their budget once they've got this guy under contract because they've matched an offer sheet? If you really wanted to sting a team and you were going to cook up an offer sheet with the player that you wanted, let's just take Leon Draisaitl, for example.
Yep.
If you wanted to sign Leon Draisaitl to an offer sheet, why not wait until 1 week before the season and then do it?
So what are you going to do? You're going to go to him in July and say, we'll make this deal, but we're not announcing it until the first week of September?
Correct.
Well, I think that would be awesome. just as a lover of carnage,
see, somebody
who likes that kind of thing.
Chaos is wonderful, isn't it?
I think it would be awesome. I couldn't see how you could do it. If you ever put that down on paper, the commissioner would fine you about 8 billion draft picks.
Don't worry. Gary Bettman's not listening to our podcast.
No, that's true.
I
have no doubt he's not listening to what we're talking about. But, hey, I would love it. I just can't see that scenario. I mean, you know, there were a couple. I know Vancouver, when Mike Gillis was running that team, there were a couple they thought of. Jamie Benn was one.
Yep.
And they were going to give him a one-year deal at, I think it was $7 million or $7.5 million. And because at that time he was a restricted free agent, it was going to be the gift that kept on giving. But at the end of the day, they decided not to do it. I know they also met with Evander Kane before Kane signed the six-year deal. That was another guy that was in their offices, and they talked to him about doing it and decided not to do it. I think a lot of teams felt that after the Shea Weber one was matched by Nashville, I remember guys telling me when that one got matched, they were saying there's no point in ever doing an offer sheet because if that one's going to get matched, none of them are ever going to be unmatched. But I do think that with less and less great players getting to the market, Jeff, I think we'll see some more.
So then when you hear Dundon say things like, hey, if this isn't, you know, sympathetic with our economics here, we'll walk away from it.
I think there's a lot of teams that would feel the same way. But, you know, Mike Tyson has a great line. It's everybody has a strategy until they get punched in the mouth.
Yep.
So I think we won't know until this actually, if it ever does happen to him. The one thing that I thought was interesting, Jeff, was I had a couple people reaching out to me saying they didn't like the story he told about Bill Peters.
Why not? I thought the Bill Peters part was fascinating. He wasn't sold on Bill Peters until he met him and started to talk to him.
Well, that was my reaction, too. I said, I think that's exactly what I would want from someone walking in. Maybe you have an impression about someone and you go see them and you realize, wow, my first impression was totally wrong or my previous impression was totally wrong. But there were people who didn't like it. They didn't like the way it came off. They thought it was insulting to Peters. I looked at it the other way around. I thought it was very good about Peters and maybe confirmed a lot of suspicions that we had about him, that he's a good coach who has that team going in the right direction and eventually is going to do something good with them.
I don't see the problem as one of coaching as much as it is a matter of composition. That's how I see the Carolina Hurricanes, and slowly and painfully they're starting to get there. They've been the hipster pick at the beginning of everyone's, you know, season for
like
however many years, right? Okay, who's going to surprise you? Man, for so many years I've said Carolina. And I've had people from the organization, you know, text me or DM me and saying, hey, thanks, but like, let's sit on the secret here for a while. Don't raise the bar for us right now.
It's like Rudy Giuliani. I'm not a big fan, but in his book, Leadership, he has two lines that are 100%. He says, you can miss weddings, but you can't miss funerals. And the second thing is, he says, set the bar low so you can jump over it.
That's right.
I like that.
To the point about Bill Peters, I first met him at the Memorial Cup when it was in Kitchener and he was with Spokane. And then I remember on the MVSW podcast talking to him a couple of different times. And he's a delightful interview. Like, he's a candid coach interview.
He's blunt.
Oh, he's blunt. And you know what? He's no BS.
Yeah.
Remember I asked him a question about working with Eric Tulsky, who heads up their analytics. And he's one of the brightest stars in that sky. And he said, yeah, it's like this. And he gave me the extension, like on the air. Here's the extension that I call when I have a question about analytics. That's the A to B relationship we have. Because as you well know, the relationship with analytics departments and the head coach tends to have a few layers in between the department and the head coach. There are some that want the analytics department to report initially to an assistant coach. From there, it gets watered down to another coach or to another person. And so the information gets watered down before it comes from that department to the head coach. Whereas with Carolina, it's an A to B relationship.
Yes.
Bill Peters talks to Tulsky.
Yes.
And that's the way it goes. And I like a progressive thinking coach like that.
Well, if you read everything the owner said, that's coming there too.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to be challenged. You know, he said, I'm going to challenge your beliefs. And if you can prove it to me, no problem. But if we change something and it makes us better, that's the way it's going to be. You know, my takeaway from Dunnan is he's got a high bar. I have no problem with that. I never have a problem. Like I joked before with what Giuliani said. I think there's nothing wrong with setting a low bar publicly, almost as a joke, but you have to set a high bar internally. And, you know, the one line he said that I really agree with is that he has no time for people who say it's never my fault, but they're always there.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all know people like that in life, and they make me crazy. And I think it's a good thing. You know, Carolina, I think it got a little bit stale. I think internally there were a lot of people there who wanted an ownership change. They wanted some new life breathed into the franchise, and now they're going to get it. And if you look at the teams in that division, you've got an owner in Pittsburgh who wants them to win every year. You've got an owner in Washington who's dying for them to win a championship. You know, it's going to be interesting where Philadelphia goes, but they were basically built on the personality of an owner to try to be great. If you're surrounded by teams in your division who want to win and have ownership that demands to win, you need that too. And that's what this guy is.
Beefing up the scouting staff. That's one thing that I drew in association with Terry Pegula. As you can remember, when Pegula bought the Buffalo Sabres, and a lot of their scouting was done
video.
By video.
Yep.
It was all video. I can tell you how many times I talked to scouts in the community that were just livid about how the Buffalo Sabres were doing anything. It was an assault on their profession. And he changed all that. And, you know, that's one of the areas that's not capped. And if you have a chance to spend, you know, try to outspend your competitor when it comes to scouting and really spread out. And you mentioned the piece that Russia a little bit.
I've heard Carolina, like people have said to me that Carolina does a really good job considering their limitations. And one is money in terms of what they pay. And there's a second facet to it, and that is money in terms of what they're willing to go see. And, you know, these other teams told me that Carolina has what is known as coverage gaps. And I said, well, where's one? They go, Russia. They really don't do a great job there. But they still found good players despite that. And I don't necessarily think that means, Jeff, that you have to hire 10,000 scouts.
Sure.
Like one team pointed out to me, L.A., they don't have the biggest staff, but they pay well and they make you go. Like they say, we're going to pay you, but you're going to earn it because you're going to be out there a lot. And it works for them. And they said that that's what Carolina needs to do. If you're not going to hire more people, you at least have to put money into saying you're going to go out there and you're going to work. But the story he told me, I didn't put it in there because there was just so much stuff, is like he said, if you tell me that we shouldn't scout 5'10" defensemen because they never work, he says, I want to see that. Prove it to me. So he says, whatever their notions are, I'm going to ask to hear them and I'm going to test them. And that's going to be interesting between ownership and scouting.
Let me ask you about 5'10" defensemen.
Yeah.
If I took two hockey players, right, just in their street clothes and put them against the wall, one was 6'4" and one was 5'10". And it was 20 years ago.
20 years ago was always 6'4".
And I said to you, which one is a defenseman and which one is the goalie?
Mm-hmm.
Who would the defenseman have been?
The 6'4" guy was the defenseman, and the 5'10" guy was the goalie.
And where are we at right now?
Now it's reversed.
100%
yes.
Reversed. Welcome to the podcast, 31 Thoughts. Let's kick it off.
Armstrong, Elliot, 31 thoughts. Thank God you're doing this podcast because I was get to about 15 thoughts and shut her down. Jeff Merrick, when I was bragging that I was working with you, Crosby said to me, hey, isn't that the iDesk guy?
The iDesk guy. The iDesk guy, Elliot.
You know what? There are worse ways you could be remembered.
I remember once, specifically, walking through the atrium at CBC, the first season Morrison and I did the iDesk, walking through the atrium, and some guys with a group of buddies shouts over at us and says, "Hey, iDesk!" Not, "Hey, Jeff, Scott." Just, "I've been identified with the desk." The only other time, and this was actually frightening, that I was ever identified with the desk from Hockey Night in Canada, the iDesk, the 30-second segment where I would talk over more scenics than anyone on Hockey Night in Canada going to commercial and throwing back to Ron, was 2011 Stanley Cup Final. And Morrison and I are outside the CBC, and the riots start as the Bruins win the Stanley Cup.
In Vancouver.
They rush us inside, and it's tear gas and cops and crystal meth fights, and it's crazy in Vancouver. And we're trying to walk back to the hotel. This brawl's on the street, right? And here's Scott and I in our, with our briefcases and our suits, trying to be as inconspicuous as possible.
Mm-hmm.
This one guy grabs another guy and it does that like running punch with him and flattens him. And the guy stands. I'm like, "Oh, like, we're not in Kansas anymore." And a couple other guys who are with the fight look over at me and Scott and go, "Hey, look, it's the guys from the iDesk." And we just sort of pick up the pick up the pace a little bit to try to get back to the hotel.
Because you're his next victims. Like, it would be punched out the guys from the iDesk.
Yeah, exactly. Put that one, that's a badge for
that, you. That is an outstanding one. The only thing I have that's even remotely close to that is after my first year at Hockey Night in Canada, I was taking the subway somewhere, and this guy comes up to me and he goes, "You're Elliot Friedman, aren't you?" And I go, "Yes." He goes, "You had a really good year at Hockey Night in Canada." I said, "Thanks." He goes, "I used to really think you sucked, but you changed my mind this year."
Goes in the preconceived motions. Thanks a lot. Notions about,
I don't think that's as good as your story, but that's the best one I got.
Take it. How about this story? And this one is interesting for a number of different reasons. Andrew Cogliano, 2-game suspension, Anaheim Ducks, Saturday night, Adrian Kempe, Los Angeles Kings. A couple of things they could have got him on. One was the interference, and the other was the headshot. Regardless of how you feel about the play itself, it ended up being a 2-game suspension, and the Iron Man streak was over for Andrew Cogliano. 830 games.
Yep.
Doug Jarvis, you can sleep well. And in your piece, I was shocked at how many players. Now, I know players put a real premium on how many games you played, how long you've been involved in the game.
Yep.
I get that. And how many guys were really incensed.
They were mad.
At this suspension.
They were really mad.
Explain why.
You know, I think you just said it, Jeff. It's that they respect streaks. Like, first of all, how many times can you play where you get knowingly injured, right? You go for a hit,
sure.
Maybe you get hurt. You're along the boards, whether you're positioned properly or not, you get hurt. And then there's all the ways you could get hurt accidentally. Like, you look at Philippe Danault on Saturday night against Boston. How often do you get hurt without even trying to, like on a play like that? And they felt for a guy with no history, they really respected the streak. They were impressed because it's not like Cogliano floats and does nothing. He's been hurt before. And one player made, I thought, was really a good point. He said when Cogliano breaks down during the interview with Ken French, he's doing it because he's thinking of all the ways he had to play hurt, or all the times he had to play hurt, and then this was the way it ended.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, I think as I don't really talk about too much as I've been going through it because, you know, you're in the process of it, but it's a tough pill to swallow. I'm not going to lie. I think I've played hard and I battled and I'm a professional and someone that I've played a long time and I missed the game. So.
And the players were mad. They respected the streak. They thought it was important. And I think they looked at it like, for a guy with no history, he should have been fined. That's it. Let him play.
So they were of the mind the Department of Player Safety should have taken the streak into consideration?
Yes. Yes.
Can they credibly do that?
Well, that was, and then the next thought, you know, I pursued that and I spoke to some people and they didn't want to speak. They said, look, the suspension video speaks and that's enough.
Yeah.
But I was able to dig into it and I heard it did come up and they did ask that question. And that is that, should we allow him to play because he doesn't have a history? And they decided at the end of the day that wasn't the precedent they wanted to set.
It is the regular season, but it is a streak. If you look at how the NHL Department of Player Safety puts a premium on playoff games,
yes,
where essentially one game counts as two. They do weigh certain games as heavier than others. I just don't know that an Ironman streak rises to that occasion, because it is the regular season.
I have to tell you now, Jeff, based on just the reaction of the players and the way they see it, it sure does. Like, if you saw Teemu Selänne tweet it,
yeah,
Ty Domi, Dave Gagne was another guy. Actually, he tweeted at me specifically that he was upset about it. I think to the players, it really matters. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember when I was younger, I think I was at the Fan still at the time, Cal Ripken came to Toronto, and this was 1994. And so it's about 4 years before he broke the record, 2 years, whatever it was.
Right.
And there were a lot of debates about, should he take a day off? And I remember thinking, do we really reward people for perfect attendance? I was like 25 years old. I was snarky, stupid, young adult. And I remember the Blue Jays telling me, like, that's a bad take. Do you know how hard it is to play every day? And we all joke like it's baseball. You're not doing anything.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, I think players see that as extremely valuable. And I know that now after the way it ended and the way people reacted. Players see it as a big deal. It's a big deal to them.
You know what? If you talk to anyone who's gone through the game, talk to any players, whether they're in the game right now or certainly ex-players feel this way. And the gym that I work out at is all hockey guys. A lot of guys in the OHL, a lot of American League guys, some NHL guys are in the summer, and a lot of ex-NHL guys. And whenever they start talking about other players, when they want to describe who the player was, the younger guys will talk about how much they earn,
mm-hmm,
and the older guys will tell you how many games they played. Cups aren't even a consideration. Oh, this guy played 1,700 games in the NHL. This guy played 1,000 games in the NHL. He's blah, 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 blah. It's unscientific, but I find that the players that are in the game are more concerned with, oh, this guy makes 6 sheets. Oh, this guy makes 5 sheets, 7 sheets. But once they're out of it, the one thing that matters to them that they look back on is, how long did you play? How long were you involved in the game?
Yeah, I always feel bad for the guys who retire or finish just shy of 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Like Martin LaPointe.
Oh, where did Martin LaPointe finish?
I think it was
at
991.
Ah!
I think I better look at this right now. I'm actually going to verify a fact I say, which doesn't happen very often.
Oh, by the way, speaking in spirit of fact-checking, a few people got to me. Pete Sarno did play 7 games in the NHL.
LaPointe, by the way, was 991. Sarno did play.
Your
okay.
game's tight. Yeah, Sarno, I think it might have been when he was still playing in the American League and before he played those games. That might have been my Weasley out on it.
Okay.
But thank you for all the fact checkers out there that
got
to me.
Oh, I know if we ever say something wrong, you guys out there are going to tell us.
Because sports is the one place, Elliot, I've always maintained this, sports is the one place, and I'm always cognizant of this when I'm doing prep, is the one place where 99% of the time, the people that are watching or listening to you are smarter than you. That is not necessarily true when it comes to politics, when it comes to entertainment. But in the media field, generally, sports fans, maybe not so much you, but maybe more a comment on me, are smarter.
No, you know what? Well, I mean, you know your hockey. There's no question. Like, if I have time to tell a story, when we worked at the Fan together with Bob Mackwood Sr.
Yep.
as the program director, they were having a focus group. And he asked me, what would you ask the focus group? And I said, I would ask the focus group, do they think they're smarter than the hosts? And he looked at me and goes, why would you ask that question? Like, that's a stupid question. And then I guess he asked it. And he came back to me later and he goes, I didn't realize
it's
in sports
good, it's a good question.
How much that's a big deal.
Huge.
I agree with you. I think people look at news and politics and they're like, I don't know the geopolitical world. Like, we're looking at our prime minister over and trying to figure out the TPP. None of us know what that means, right?
Trans-Pacific Protocol, by the way, folks. I'm paying attention at home.
I didn't even know what that meant.
Okay.
But all of us think we know better than any NHL coach. So I do believe, Jeff, that's a big deal. If fans think they know more than the people delivering the sports news, they don't respect them.
Really quick before I get to a break,
is why I am totally disrespected.
Getting back to Anaheim, Los Angeles and the Andrew Cogliano situation, there are very few, and as we record this, tonight's going to be the Montreal Canadiens and the Boston Bruins on our Wednesday night hockey presentation. Elliot is part of it. And it'll be positioned as this great rivalry, and it's 4-hour games and endless brawls and blood and Jim Henry and Maurice Richard shaking hands at center ice and bowed and bloodied. It's not going to be that. You know, it hasn't been that for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But true or false, the one rivalry that reminds us of eras like that, what used to be the Battle of Alberta is now the Battle of California, L.A. and Anaheim.
They're the best games in the league.
Yep.
And even when San Jose plays the other two teams, those are good games too. But L.A. Anaheim are the best games in the NHL right now. And I think we both believe that the fact that Cogliano's hit on Kempe came seconds, literally, after three consecutive fights.
Yeah, that weighed in.
That was a factor, too.
It certainly was. All right, we'll take a pause on the podcast. 31 Thoughts returns after these brief messages.
Saturday. It's going to be a good day. Always is. It's because of all the games during the week. The one played on Saturday night is a special one. This is the story of a love affair between a country and a game. If you want to try and teach someone about Canada, you go to the television Saturday night, and it becomes crystal clear. Hockey Night in Canada on CBC and Sportsnet.
So maybe the first time that I realized in the salary cap era how crucial it was to have many more defensemen than it might appear that you need before the playoffs was 2007 with the Anaheim Ducks, who during their playoff run got to Ken Huskins and Rick Jackman and Joe DePenta pretty fast, and it really helped them. To that end, in 31 Thoughts this week, you write about the market being flooded by defensemen, but not just depth defensemen, like not just bottom pairing guys. Guys can play up a little bit higher in your lineup if you're ready to swallow a price tag.
Well, Jack Johnson kind of got it going with his demand to be traded last week, although I'm not convinced that's going to happen. But there's Paul Martin, who is going to play some games in the American Hockey League just to get going. There's Dion Phaneuf, although he's got 4 years left. Eventually, Mike Green's going to hit the market. So I think you're going to be looking at some guys. I think Ottawa, maybe Cody Ceci too. You know, I think Tampa will definitely be in the market for somebody, even when Hedman gets back. It's going to be very interesting to see Arizona, if they ever consider Hjalmarsson or Demers. Mm-hmm. And I know everyone talks about Ekman-Larsson, but I'm not sure if they're at that point yet, although who knows what the future holds. You know, I think there's going to be some interesting guys. And the one thing, though, somebody was saying to me was, all of a sudden there's a lot of sellers. How many buyers are there? And I didn't even mention Ryan McDonagh yet.
And you think that's legit, Ryan McDonagh?
I think they'll listen. I don't necessarily think they'll do it, but I think they're going to listen. Mm-hmm. How many buyers are there?
How many buyers are there?
Yes.
You see, you think that there are more sellers than there are
I'm
buyers.
I'm beginning to see that.
Okay, well, why don't we go through the NHL teams here as I pull this up.
Go through the standings page.
And, of course, as I do that, my NHL.com freezes on my laptop.
Well, okay, let's do this the easy way. And there's Ian Cole. You know, Ian Cole's another guy.
That's been out there for a while.
It's been out there for a while, but he's still out there.
I think Olli Maatta. That's a name for Pittsburgh.
That name's been out there before.
That's been out there for a while. There was once something, I think, between Pittsburgh and Winnipeg, and his name popped up.
Okay. Washington, I think, will look for a D. Now, I'd heard Burakovsky's name, but that got denied to me, and I've heard they don't want to deal Vrana. They prefer to keep him. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to see what Washington's willing to do. New Jersey, I don't know if they're going to make any trades, but they've been looking for D. Tampa Bay, yes.
Tampa Bay, yes, or Tampa Bay is going to see what they have with Slater Cooper?
Well, I think they're going to see what they have, but I still think they will consider upgrading.
This is a fascinating year for Slater Cooper. This, in a lot of ways, is show-me season for Slater Cooper. And with the organization for long enough that they should know what they have in Slater Cooper. Like, in a lot of ways, when I looked at this season and all the players that you would circle and have questions about, so one of the guys in the blue line that had the questions about was Cooper. And if it goes great this season, that's it. He's part of the Bolts. But if not, it's almost as if this is the season where Tampa says maybe there's not something there that we thought once was.
I still think they look and see what's out there. I still think they look.
Okay.
Boston, I think they'd look for a left shot, but they're not giving up any of their big guys. Toronto's a big one. I think they'll be looking for D. But then after that, Islanders, yes.
Yep.
Who else in the East? Carolina doesn't
need
them.
You don't think Penguins are looking?
I think the Penguins are looking for a forward.
Vander Kane fit there?
Maybe. Center. They're looking for a center more, I think. So in the East, we've got Washington, Tampa, Toronto, maybe Boston.
New Jersey.
But the New Jersey is weird to me. Like, I don't see them stepping up to take that big swing for the fences.
I think in a lot of ways, New Jersey looks at this as found money.
Exactly.
That they're a year ahead of schedule.
We'll do it if it makes sense. But I think Islanders do. Because they have to swing for the fences.
Yes, because of John Tavares. Anything more on that situation?
I think they just let it wait and play out.
Oh, it's so risky.
Well, first of all, what trade are you going to make where you're getting a better player?
I get it. Like, I understand.
And
you're not going to win that deal.
Love that guy.
But what are your fans going to do if he walks for it? No thing.
I think you look at it and you say, unless he comes to you and tells you, I'm not signing, you play it out. And you know what? The Stamkos thing, and I know it's not Tampa, and I know it doesn't have the same state taxes as Tampa. You have to play it out. I think they are doing the right thing by letting it play out. You have to wait until John Tavares says to you, I'm not signing.
Winnipeg Jets to the West.
They need a D?
No, they don't. They may be shopping a D. I wonder if Winnipeg shops Buffalo.
I've wondered about that. But
Trouba and Morrissey have been killing
The thing is, though, is that can you afford to trade Buffalo if you don't know if you're keeping Trouba beyond 2 years?
Legit.
You got Buffalo under contract for 3 more years.
Yep.
Can you afford to trade him until you know if Jacob Trouba's staying?
It might be a small sample, but how much did the fact that they kept on winning, thank you very much, when Buffalo wasn't in the lineup?
I think that's something. But still, there's short-term and there's long-term. And long-term, what if Trouba leaves? And you've traded Bufflin, and all of a sudden your right side is Myers and what? So you've gone from having Myers, Trouba, and Bufflin to maybe having just Myers. Kevin Cheveldayoff doesn't strike me as a guy who would walk into that trap.
No. Nashville, no.
St. Louis, no.
Nashville's got Dante Fabro coming. There's still more really good defensive coming for Nashville.
I think St. Louis's whole plan depends on how healthy Bouwmeester is.
Okay.
Vegas is not adding significantly. San Jose is trying to trade a D. Calgary
might be adding a D.
Maybe. Dallas, maybe.
I could see Dallas adding a D.
I could
see Los Angeles adding a D. I could see Minnesota adding a D. Colorado
and Chicago.
Found money.
Chicago, this whole thing with Corey Crawford, though, I'm curious to see what this is going to mean.
All right, pause on that because there's conflicting reports about it's going to cost the season.
Here's what happened.
It's going to cost the season.
I can explain this. So Nick was actually the first guy to bring it up on the, what do we call that segment, headlines?
Saturday headlines. Yes.
Yeah. So Nick brought it up, and he heard that it was concussion-like symptoms. And that was 2 weeks ago. And then I heard last week that they were really worried about it, but I wasn't getting anywhere. So I wrote Monday for Tuesday, and I read a story in the Chicago paper on Monday saying Quenneville said he was going to be back. And I was like, oh, okay, that's good, because I heard that they were really worried about it. And then Mark Lazarus, who wrote that story I read, reached out to me, direct message on Twitter, and he said, you know, when did you hear that? Because that quote from Quenneville was like January 6th. I was like, oh, so this quote that was in the paper 2 days ago was actually said January 6th. I didn't realize that. And I'll take responsibility for that. But I said, well, actually, I heard it last week. And he goes, well, that's after he said it. And I go, uh-oh. I guess Mark then went and checked it out. And someone said to him, yeah, they're worried about it. So, and he sent me back a note saying maybe I loosened the ketchup bottle a little bit. But I think Mark's story today is legit. I think they are worried about it.
So this means...
And when Nick said concussion symptoms, you know, it's funny. People used to get really angry when you say concussion symptoms, either concussion or it's not.
Right.
And I used to agree with that thinking, Jeff, but I've moved away from it.
Okay,
now.
Explain why. Because a lot of people have a hard time
because
with
of Crosby.
Because it was concussion symptoms, but it was the neck.
Because they believe now it was a neck injury as opposed to concussion symptoms. So it's unfortunate, and a lot of you medical doctors out there won't like it, but there is, again, I think some gray area. But vertigo could be a concussion symptom and not a concussion. So I believe that Mark's story today is accurate. I think they're worried about it. You know, if you're a baseball fan, you're my age, and I'm 47 – you remember Nick Isasky, a power hitter from Cincinnati, went to Boston, hit 30 home runs with the Red Sox. I think it was like 1989, and then he never played again. Vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it can be a big problem. Plus, so, if you're a Hitchcock person, Vertigo, great movie.
So then, one of the finest. Then the question becomes, is Chicago, because we all thought they were fishing for a defenseman, could they now be fishing for a netminder instead? The thinking being, if you look at the two most recent deals, whether it's Cody Franzen or the Declaire deal, it almost seems as if that was a setup to an even bigger deal by Chicago.
Maybe.
And where we all thought, oh, defenseman, should we now be thinking netminder, and should we be thinking Jimmy Howard?
He's got, what, one or two more years left? How are they going to add cap, add money?
So what do they do? If Chicago's not going to fold it.
I don't think they're going to fold it. Knowing that organization and the way they think, I can't see them folding it. Plus, jobs are on the line, as incredible as it sounds. I just cannot see them folding. The John McDonough, Stan Bowman, Joel Quenneville, Chicago Blackhawks do not fold. They are all in.
When you say jobs are on the line, because Quenville's name has been out there forever. Well, I think more wrongly than rightly.
Well,
and I think we're all on the same page.
It's crazy. It is crazy that Joel Quenneville could be fired. Crazy.
I agree, and everybody agrees.
But
and
it's possible.
Taking my kitchen off the bench. Opening salvo.
It's craziness, but it could happen. And then he could pick and choose what he wants to do.
He will be unemployed as long as he wants to be unemployed.
As long as he wants to be unemployed. He could get Babcocked by someone.
Reset the marketplace for the rest of coaches?
Or be right there.
I want to get to some Twitter questions here. We didn't do it last week. We're going to get to it this week.
This is Ask31.
This is hashtag Ask31. Here we go. From Joseph. This is an interesting one. Do you think we'll see Olympic clauses in contracts after the next CBA?
I think players would like to do it. I just don't know if it would be possible, simply because it's the league that has to clear your contract to go play at the Olympics, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you could do that.
So what is the next battle then?
The next battle is Olympics, period.
And is that something that the NHL players are willing to strike over?
I think if they were going to strike over something, it would be more about the escrow than the Olympics. I think it's a great question. I just, from what I understand about the way it works, I think a team could say, sure, we'll give you that clause, but a league could void it.
All right, this comes to us from, this is a funny one, from Andrew. Andrew, Avs fan here. My team can't be this good, right? Hashtag Ask31.
You know, I got to tell you, we all thought they'd be useless without Varlamov, and they're winning with Bernier. I think they're much improved. And McKinnon, I think, is in the Hart Trophy conversation if they make the playoffs. I just think last year, everything went wrong. In this NHL, it's hard to be as bad as they were last year, but it was just such a nightmare year. I think, to their credit, there's a lot of guys who said, we're not doing that again. I think Bednar is a much better coach than he was able to show last year. And McKinnon had another level, and he's getting himself there, and Rantanen looks like a great pick. And this league, too, like, if you are good enough to stay close, you're good enough to win games.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're pretty legit.
You know, they get knocked a lot for the Ryan O'Reilly deal with the Buffalo Sabres. And sure, Grigorenko's not around anymore, and that was one of the key pieces there. But Zadorov's not playing bad, and JT Compher's a good player.
JT Compher is a good player. It wasn't a great deal. It wasn't. But the thing I give the Colorado Avalanche the most credit for was they stuck to their guns on Duchene. They said, we know what mistakes we made, and we're not doing that again.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, Joe Sakic does not get stressed out. I think he was stressed out.
Do you think Joe Sakic still wants to be a GM?
I think that he would much rather have the Shanahan role, maybe.
Yeah.
And that's why I think they pursued Kyle Dubas last year. But those guys, Sakic, Chris McFarlane, they did a great job with this.
Oh, yeah. Listen,
they went immediately from a lot of people saying, what the hell are they doing, to those guys are pretty smart.
You and I have talked about this before. The one reason they could do it is because they had two other teams involved as opposed to just dealing
with
one.
But they created the market.
They did that. And you know what? Even if they just got Samuel Girard out of all that, you'd be saying to that, you know what? They're in a tough situation. They have a good player, but they got a really good defenseman who's mm-hmm. going to be a cornerstone of that blue line for a long time. And then even more so, rewind to the draft last year. And I know, listen, it's green bananas, but Cale Makar and Connor Timmins.
Yeah, Cale Makar looks really good, eh?
He does, and so does Connor
Timmins.
So does Timmins. The only drag, if you're an Avalanche fan, man, I'm splitting hairs here, is that you're good right now. Because if you weren't, you'd be in the sweepstakes for Rasmus Dahlin.
They might still be. You know, you got to get in. Well, don't forget last year. Who won the lottery,
Oh, no,
right?
Colorado got decimated
no,
in the lottery.
Nobody gets decimated more than Vancouver.
I know they get. And Buffalo, listen, Buffalo a couple of years ago tried to do everything to get Connor McDavid.
The biggest one was Arizona that year.
Yes.
Because Buffalo and Arizona were in the Tank Bowl.
Yeah.
And Edmonton won, and Arizona was the one that ended up third.
But don't forget with Buffalo and Tim Murray. I mean, anytime a goaltender had a nerve to make a save, he was getting traded. That's not what we do here this season, Mr. Goalie, sir.
It's a story I'm going to write later this year. It's how the draft lottery has become the biggest day on the NHL calendar.
Hmm.
There's no day that's more important to the future of franchises than the draft lottery.
Especially now where you're sending franchise-changing players.
You think Toronto's getting $800 million from Scotiabank if they don't win the Auston Matthews lottery?
Not a chance.
Someday I'm going to write a book, and it's going to be titled How Auston Matthews Saved Everybody's Job.
Oh, I like that. Ba-ba-ba. This comes to us from Zeke Hartman. How does the league plan to realign after adding Seattle? Seems difficult to kick a team out of the Pacific where Seattle logically fits. Calgary and Edmonton aren't splitting. Arizona or Vegas makes the most sense. But doesn't the league want to try to stoke a rivalry there? #Ask31.
Yes, I think it depends. Is Arizona, like in a couple years, I don't think this Arizona situation is going to keep lurching along. Now they have Houston. And if Arizona doesn't get a new building by the time Seattle's ready, I could see Seattle coming in, Arizona going to Houston, and then you have a Houston-Dallas rivalry.
And that was promised once upon a time, wasn't it? Back in the Les Alexander saber-rattling days?
Yes.
State rival for the Dallas Stars? I love this one. From anonymous listener. Should the Flyers make a push for the playoffs with the current roster, or should they call up more of the kids, get them experience, and possibly miss out? #Ask31. Flyers are kind of in there, and Claude Giroux is rejuvenated. And listen, Sean Couturier is playing the best hockey of his life.
You know, I think Ron Hextall and Dave Hextall, they have a plan. I don't know if they'll ever admit it publicly, but I think their plan was to really go next year. I think they really thought they were a year away.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if this has changed it. So I think everything this year, they're going to go with the plan that they had and see where it takes them.
What do they do at deadline? Sit?
Maybe add, but not if it costs them anything that they think is valuable.
See, you wonder about, and again, how many times have you heard this one before? But you always wonder about the net mining Philadelphia. And you can't sit and wait on Carter Hart.
Carter Hart is...
We all think going to be a bona fide number one netminder in the NHL. Man, he's a goalie.
Yeah.
And you don't know.
Put him in the AHL, you see what he does. Or maybe you give him 9 games at the beginning of next year. But it's always harder with a goalie. I see Philadelphia as having a long-term plan, and nothing they do is going to interfere with that plan.
This from @WestCorey. What is Edmonton going to do to right the ship next year? And how serious was the offer sheet threat for Leon Draisaitl?
I think there were teams that considered it. I don't think the offer sheet ever got close. I know there were people who thought it might come, but I don't think it was ever close.
As far as writing the ship for next season? Because you've talked about everything about Edmonton being about next year.
Yes, and I do think Edmonton kind of thought at the time they were getting Draisaitl for 7.5 instead of 8.5. Like, there are rumors that there was something close at the draft for 7.5 and it just didn't happen and they had to go to the higher number. I do think Edmonton looks at it like, okay, we now know we weren't as good as last year, but we're not as bad as this year. And I think everything they do is about how can we contend next year. Now, I will tell you that I think one of the problems with the Oilers is that they are so blindsided by how they are this year that it's taking them a while to come to grips with it and figure out what that means. And I think that right now they're going through an evaluation stage, which is we have to figure out what we really have here and who we can really count on. Who are our guys? And the tough thing is that you really liked Larson last year. You don't like Larson this year. What do you have? You really like Klefbom this year.
Ditto for Klefbom.
But I think Klefbom was playing pretty hurt.
The saving grace on that blue line
is Nurse.
Darnell Nurse.
And you got to give him a new contract. And what are you doing? I think you're asking a lot of questions about who do you really have and who can you really count on?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the biggest question is Draisaitl. He got that weird concussion at the beginning of the year. He hasn't been the same.
It almost seems as if when he's not playing with Connor, and listen, Connor wants to play with Leon Draisaitl on the right side. He wants to have that skill around him. But if you're the Edmonton Oilers, you want that skill spread out, if you believe.
You want the options.
You want, and don't you want Leon Draisaitl as your number two centerman?
Want the option. Sometimes I want them together. Sometimes I want them apart. I want the options. I want the options in the same game. I remember, and I'm not going to say who the coach was because Bowman really disagreed with the coach. But I once got an email from Scotty Bowman after a game where he talked about one team having two great players, and it was a game seven, and it infuriated him why when you were in the offensive zone, they weren't on the ice together for every offensive zone draw. And I've always remembered that. I like creativity. I like flexibility. And I think at some point in time, they have to have a big talk with Draisaitl about what does he think went wrong this year, mm-hmm. and how are they going to fix that to make sure that doesn't happen again. Because he hasn't been himself.
The big issue has to be fixing that left side. That's a huge one for Edmonton, and it's going to be tough.
You got to find cheap guys, right? That's what Pittsburgh's done. They found cheap guys. Sherry. Sorry, Connor. I'm all confused now. I don't know how to pronounce it anymore.
Sherry this year.
Gensel. Yeah. They found those guys.
A lot of those guys had the Sidney Crosby magic wand waved over them, though.
Hey, so
give it to Crosby, right. Man. I'm telling you, man.
Magic wand.
We haven't
there
seen
shouldn't
it. Have
be...
we seen it yet?
I mean, well,
maybe the Patrick Maroon.
There should be a Leon Draisaitl magic wand too.
There's not.
I don't know. The way I saw that guy play, to me, the big test to me, Jeff, is how do you play against Anaheim? That guy last year against Anaheim was a beast.
But isn't that part of the problem with that contract? That they saw how he played that series against Anaheim. They saw how he played in the playoffs. And it is a small sample size, and they based the contract on that. When general managers make contracts, do they not make more mistakes based on what they saw in the playoffs versus what they've seen all season?
Maybe, but where are you judged by?
I'm just saying, rightly or wrongly, and I would submit more wrongly than rightly, how many players have been rewarded with outrageous contracts based on what they do in the playoffs?
Yeah, probably quite a few. But at the end of the day, if you don't win in the playoffs, and the toughest thing is to get there, you got to get there. But the fact is, you're judged by wins and losses in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
Look, we're having this ridiculous conversation about Joel Quenneville. And, you know, like, if he doesn't even get there, he could get fired. I mean, how crazy
is
that?
That's asinine, I know. A couple more really quick. From Armin, who holds the most responsibility for personality, or lack thereof, problems when it comes to the NHL, where outside of guys like PK, the NHL personalities are tampered down, and what impact does it have on trying to sell the game in today's sports world?
This is part of a larger conversation, and I've thought a lot about how I would like to tackle this and write this in someday. I believe the NHL is going to be forced to change. I believe this generation is moving the line, and I believe that the line will continue to move. And the NHL has always been conservative, and there's good things about that, and there's bad things about that. But I think if you look at the world today, and you can argue about good or bad, whatever you want, I really don't care. I'm just interested in the fact that this is a fact. Youth is changing. It's a lot more of a reality world. It's a lot more of putting myself out there on social media world. The NHL is going to be forced to change with that. You know, we talked about Thomas Dunn in the beginning of the podcast. He said, where's the NHL going to be in 10 years? You have to evolve with it. I believe the league's personality is going to change. They will not be able to be as conservative as they are, and it's going to move.
It's funny because I was thinking about this the past couple of seasons, and I don't think that the NHL was in a position to do it while the 100-year anniversary was hanging over its head.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the one thing I think the league needs to get away from, and we're as guilty of this as anybody else in hockey media, is get away from the burden of history. I'm not saying you ignore it or disrespect it, but let's just put it in its proper context. There's a lot of really exciting things happening about the game today and about the players today. And the lessons from years gone by are the lessons from years gone by. But to your point, there is a new reality in the NHL. And there's a new vibe of hockey players. I don't know that it is accurately reflected in the way the game is presented. I agree with you. I just think that the weight of history,
yes,
with this 100-year anniversary has been on top of the league now for years. And now that it is done, now the 100-year anniversary is over. now I think you chart the course.
I completely disagree. I don't think it's the weight of history.
You don't think that this sport is weighed down by history?
No, I really don't. I don't. I think they celebrate their history, but, you know, Jeff, maybe it's because certain things happen in my life. I don't believe in legacies. I don't. I went to a school a little while ago, and these kids were, you know, they were, sorry, it was first year universities. They're 18, 19 years old. And they're like, what do you think your legacy will be? And I was like,
wow.
I don't care. Like, I'll be dead. Like, I won't care what my legacy is. I really don't. And I think that what happens is, look, the NBA, I love basketball. Look at the crazy week we've had. Like, we've had guys trying to go into other teams' dressing rooms and stuff like that. One player, LeBron James, has been to the NBA Finals 7 consecutive years. That's incredible. And he lords over whatever teams he's on because he can. And in the NHL, we've got one of the best players, Connor McDavid, probably going to miss the playoffs this year. The difference between why I think it is that one player cannot determine the fortunes of a franchise in the NHL like they can in the NBA, or even to some degree the NFL.
They're not on the playing surface long enough.
They're not. They cannot do it. And that allows the sport to stay conservative. And that will probably always be the case. One player cannot change the franchise of a team. It can help, but you can't do it fully. I just believe the sheer force of personality and what interests the younger generation, that will move the NHL into a place it's never been before. And there will be battles. Like, there's no, we're seeing it play out in Toronto right now. Mike Babcock and his young players. We're seeing that play out. There's a lot of great things about hockey. In a me world, I like the we it creates. But I also think there's more room for us to showcase that our players are creative people. In some way, in the next 10 to 20 years, that marriage is going to be forced on us. And it's not going to be easy, but it's going to happen. And I think the NHL as a whole has to recognize that and has to embrace it.
We're out of time.
But you want to come back at me, so just...
No, I don't. Because I want to hit pause on that. I want to pick up that exact conversation on the next podcast, and I want to use a Twitter question we got from someone who you're going to get very familiar with, one by the name of Karen Douglas, who used to listen to the MVSW podcast and sent really insightful stuff all the time.
Okay.
And she sent a really interesting tweet that talks about what you're talking about vis-a-vis TED Talks. So hold on to that thought, and Elliot and I will rejoin you in 6 days. We're doing the next podcast next Tuesday on the 31 Thoughts, the podcast. So thanks a lot for joining us today. On behalf of Elliot Friedman and our producer, Emil Delich, Jeff Merrick signing off. Thank you so much for listening. Please read Elliot's piece at sportsnet.ca and watch us on TV. Be nice like that.